Today's Takeaway podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I say that so casually every day. Sometimes I get told you don't have to say that every day, and they're probably right. But it's one of those things my mama learned me long ago that I can't unlearn. And there's no reason to. I mean, there's no reason to stop. I certainly want to say thank you, for instance, to this person for listening.
This is Nikki from Oakland, California. Years ago, I helped a young woman from the GED program write an op-ed for a major business journal. Several years later, I encountered her again. And this previously guarded young woman not only remembered me, she opened her arms wide to give me a wonderful embrace. She said she was so grateful that someone believed she had something important to say to the world. It was my most heartwarming moment in 3 decades of nonprofit work.
And I want to thank this person for listening.
Hi, this is Frank from Westbury. I donate a lot of things to orphanages in the West Indies, and one time the children got together and made me this incredible card with pictures on it, and just a simple signature and what they wanted to be in life. It was the best thing I ever got.
Nice. On the day after Thanksgiving, it's our traditional moment to thank you for all the stories and ideas and facts and corrections you send us out of caring for this community we call the Takeaway. And yes, thanks even to those of you out there who want to toss a wet sponge at my head sometimes. That's why we have this number, 877-8-MY-TAKE, our Facebook page, thetakeaway.org, our Twitter handle. This hour, it's all about you, our listeners. We use this day to hand over the show to you and give you a chance to elaborate on the great stories you tell us throughout the year. And we begin with the joys and complexities of that simple expression, thank you. You will perhaps be hearing a lot of those this weekend, especially elaborate thank yous to members of the military that have become a ritual at national sporting events like this surprise soldier homecoming at the beginning of an NFL Jacksonville Jaguars game.
Fans, please welcome back Petty Officer Cook, who has just returned from Afghanistan. Special thanks to Petty Officer Cook and to all of our servicemen and women here tonight. Wells Fargo, with you when it's time to support the heroes in our community.
A sweet moment, but you can also hear the ritual. Wells Fargo Bank sponsored this thank you moment. Former Lance Corporal Sean Graham, who served in Iraq in 2003, has heard a lot of these thank yous. He's a Takeaway listener and has heard over and over again this expression, thank you for your service. He says that in all that time, he's learned to sort the real from the ritual.
I hear it a lot, especially around Veterans Day, I hear it. And I get some that are very sincere, and you can tell when somebody's very sincere when they say it. And there's some times where I get it where it seems like they're just doing it because it's the social thing to do, that it's the social norm to say that. But there's no actual feeling or emotion behind it when they say it.
You know, I'm wondering if this all points up to just how divided we are. There's the people who know the military and who live the military culture. And then there's people who have never spent any time, even in an elevator, with someone who served in Iraq or Afghanistan. You think that's a part of this here?
Absolutely. I even notice it with my family. You know, I have my grandfather served in the Army for a very brief period between Korea and Vietnam. And he understands things just from that brief time of service different than, say, my mother or my aunt or my uncle who never served, who have never been pro-military for that matter. And they tend to not realize things are a little bit different after you have served. When you get out, your perspective is definitely a little bit different than before you served.
So when you went into Iraq, how did you feel about what you were doing?
I was one of the few people that was a little hesitant about going to Iraq because I wasn't sure that we had a justified reason to go there. I had mixed feelings about being sent over there. Obviously, I signed up to serve my country, and my country called on me to go over there, so I did that. But I wasn't 100% sure or convinced that we should be going over there.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because certainly lots of people, whether they were in the service or not, had misgivings about that. We look back on that war now and see the situation with ISIS and scratch our heads all together. Maybe that'll bring us together here a little bit. But before we go, we're asking everybody on this day after Thanksgiving, you know, what is the most sincere, best thank you you ever received, either for your service or for anything else in your life, Sean?
The best thank you I ever received was actually a hand-drawn card with a hand-drawn picture from an 8-year-old that was mailed to me. Actually, our whole unit had them mailed from an elementary school thanking us for our service. And we had already been deployed for several months, and it touched me that a child would take the time to draw a picture and send me a thank you note, a child who is innocent, that has no comprehension of why we're there and doesn't agree or disagree with why we're there. They just know that they have men and women who are going to serve their country, and they're thankful that we're there. And that really, that was the most heartfelt thank you I ever received in my life.
So that 8-year-old is probably 21 now and might even be considering going to the Marines. Who knows? What would you say to him?
I would give them a thank you in return, because that thank you card lingered in my head the whole time I was over there. As a matter of fact, it lingered in my head beyond me separating from the military. I kind of always had it in the back of my head that here was this child that knew nothing about me on a personal level. I had never met him, yet they sent me a hand-drawn thank you card simply for my service.
Well, Sean Graham, thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Now, here's another listener with a tale of gratitude that might surprise you.
Many years ago, in an unexpected act of kindness, a friend, someone I really didn't know very well, pulled me out of a woman's shelter with my child and got me into college and on track. I was told to pay it forward, and years later, I did so. I am now the parent of 13 children, all who have gone off to college. I pulled children out of foster care and improved their lives, since my life was so dramatically improved at a very delicate moment in my own life.
Medina Cardona has lived his life as a thank you to someone who helped him back before he transitioned, back when he was a woman, when he was very confused and lost, and hope did not seem like an option.
I was living in Illinois, and I was the single parent of a 18-month-old child. And I found myself living in a woman's shelter for a short period of time. There was a gentleman who was living in Oregon who knew of my story through extended family. And he bought me a plane ticket for myself and my daughter and flew us out to Oregon. He essentially gave me the keys to his car, had me register for college, and he told me, here's your chance, go fix your life. And I set out to do that, stumbled, of course, many times along the way, but at some point I went back to him with a small amount of cash, and I wanted to start to repay him. I had no idea how much he had spent. I know that he had bought the plane ticket. He had hired an attorney because I had a minor child, and you don't simply move across the country with a child. You need permission from the court because the other parent, you know, has rights to see the child. So, and the first payment that I tried to hand to him, he said, no, you're going to keep that. You need that. I want you later in life to be able to help somebody else. So it was his way of saying, pay it forward.
You said it so eloquently in your phone call to us almost a year ago. Pay it forward by pulling kids from foster care. And that's what
Yes.
you've done, right?
I have. I've fostered, I don't even know how many kids. Some children would arrive in the middle of the night, delivered by police officers. Some of them I would pick up at the DHS offices. Some of them I've picked up from other foster homes. They transferred to my home. I'm sure more than 20 kids. I ended up adopting a few of the kids. and keeping connections with their mothers, or where in the cases where it wasn't appropriate with the mothers, we kept contact with the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles.
And you underwent an extraordinary transformation in the course of all of this transformation that, you know, changed your life. Explain to us what that was.
I think you're referring to my transition, my gender transition.
Right, right.
Yes. So I raised the kids up, and they all went off to college. And there was a point at which I decided to come out to my children and to my friends and family. My kids, you know, processed the whole thing and said, "Great, what do we call you?"
That would be the first question.
And I said, "Well, you can call me Mom. That works for me. If it works for you, we do get strange looks when we're in public and they call me Mom. So they sometimes will call me Medina when we're out about town." Yeah, the grandbabies will be calling me Grandpa. So we had a wonderful family day. We went to the Trans Pride this last summer, and it was quite exciting. There was a lot of people there, a lot of people that I knew. And so I was walking in this parade for the first time, sort of coming out to, you know, the entire city of Portland. And my children marched with me. My daughter carried a sign that said, "My mom is an awesome grandpa." And my grandson was in a stroller with the little sign saying, "I love my trans grandpa."
That's really, really terrific. Well, how do you convey this message of pay it forward to all of your foster kids and your biological kids and all those grandbabies?
You know, children, of course, learn by example. And I was surrounded pretty much by people who helped me. I was a single mom for most of this. And so there was always people who would meet my children. My children are absolutely charming and adorable. Not that I'm biased, but they would get the attention of people in the community. And there were always people who came forward to be helpful, whether that was with tutoring or babysitting. And they were always surrounded by this community effort. And one of my daughters took custody for a short period of time of her nephew, her biological nephew, who ended up in foster care. And so they clearly have absorbed that, you know, community attitude and are carrying it forward.
It sounds like you've got a really great family and community around you, and we are honored to have your family and community in our Takeaway family and community.
Well, thank you.
Medina Cardona is a foster mother and listens to The Takeaway on OPB in Portland, Oregon. Miss saying a thank you in a relationship, and it can be a real killer. But remember one, and it can maybe save the love of your life. We get a lot of relationship stories from you, and this was one of our favorites from this year. Takeaway listener Alice McKaylee Sagel, who reached out around Valentine's Day with a love story that started over 13 years ago. She and her husband first met at work, and as they began to get to know each other, there were some details that made things a little complicated right off the bat.
During the dinner, he said, "Well, if my parents arrange a marriage, what would you do?" I kind of looked at him and said, "Well, that would be up to you if you decide to go along with it."
Wait a minute. If my parents arrange a marriage, we're not talking
yes.
about Presbyterians here.
No. So my husband's from India, and he is Hindu. And that's actually part of why I think we kept going back and forth internally with our own selves and with each other. Like, okay, let's go out. Maybe not. And his parents were looking for a wife for him in India. So that was pretty interesting.
So did that put pressure on you, or did that feel like, well, he's got a backup. If I ditch him, he's going to be fine?
Both ways, right? It's pressure of...
I wouldn't know.
What am I competing with? And also, the truth is, we never have control over anybody. So we just kind of go with what's presented. And I believe in just kind of going with the flow and seeing what happens, because you never know what's perfect in life.
And you discovered that you were attracted, but you also discovered in this early period that you weren't necessarily compatible. I mean, you were kind of the Bickersons there for a while.
Yeah, we were. We were very argumentative. But I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that we were kind of like, different cultures. And not to put words in my husband's mouth, but from my own perspective, I had worked as a social worker before going to work at this other company. And I saw some of the fallout of just how life is very difficult and how hard it is to keep a family going in the same direction, and how hard it can be when you don't have the same values. Not necessarily the same faith, but the same values.
And it looked, though, about 13 years ago, like it wasn't going to work out. You kind of pushed a decision in, the late summer of 2001, and boom, that was going to be it. What was going on?
The last week in August, I went to a childhood friend's wedding. She was also actually marrying an Indian. And it was a beautiful wedding, but I thought, well, if they can figure this out, why can we not figure this out? And we went looking for books on interracial marriages, and specifically Hindu-Christian marriages. We went to 11 bookstores, and there wasn't a book on Hindu-Christian marriages. And we Googled it, and it didn't bring anything up. We had another long conversation, and I told him, you can't have a marriage with two people holding the faith of we'll survive this.
So your message to him was, look, we either have to figure this out together or we're done.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly.
What was the date on the calendar at this point?
That was September 10th, 2001.
Whoa.
Yeah. And we were up crying. It was horrible. It even brings tears to my eyes now. It was so miserable. And he left probably about 1 a.m. I was up crying for a little bit longer because I thought, well, this is it. You know, we decide now or we have to part ways. And the next morning I got up and went to work out in the gym. We had an on-campus gym and I had the gym all to myself and I had the radio on. And the folks on the radio started talking about planes flying into the World Trade Center. And my mother was on the phone, very panicked because my siblings are all in the military and their spouses, and they all immediately went on high alert. Later that evening, my husband called. He was out with his friends. They had made plans for drinks. And he said, well, I just want to make sure you're okay and that your family is okay. And I said, we're all fine. And I asked where he was. And he said, well, we're down on 6th Street having some drinks. I said, you know, I really would like you to go home. And he asked, why? And I said, well, you're watching planes fly into buildings over and over again, and people are drinking, and people are afraid, and they don't know what to do. And I'm worried for you. And I think that when people are afraid, they do things that are really horrible. So I'd like you to go home. And he kind of scoffed, and he's like, we live in Austin. It's what are you talking about? And I said, please just humor me and go home and be safe. I think people are very welcoming and very liberal here. But the population of Indian people in Austin at the time were mostly students, and it was quite small. And so my big concern was that people in bars would look at the table of Indian men and say, they're brown. They're not speaking Spanish. They must be the enemy. And he showed up on my doorstep about 30 minutes later and said, I don't actually want to be broken up, and I think we need to talk about this some more.
Well, well done.
Thank you.
And how long have you been married?
One. We've been married now almost 12 years. One of the really interesting things was we chose to have our wedding in India because my husband had not been home in 15 years. And so that was really a homecoming for him. We stayed with his maternal grandmother. Her name was Biji. She didn't speak any English, and I don't speak Hindi, sadly. But every morning she and I would get up and have tea together, and she would tell me a story in Hindi, and I would tell her a story in English, and we would just giggle and giggle. But one of the family members told me that she had gone to the pundit because his parents had asked her to help looking for a bride for my husband. And when she went to the pundit, who's the minister for Hindus, he told her he's already found his wife. Just leave it be. And no one knew that he was dating me at the time. So that was really super special. And she passed away a month after we got married. So it was really a great gift. And one of the things that someone translated from her to me, which really resonates, is every day we make decisions. Every day we choose what we're doing and who we're spending our time with.
Our thanks to Takeaway listener Alice McKaylee-Sagel. She listens to The Takeaway on KUT in Austin, Texas. Last April, our friends at WLRN in South Florida rolled out a whole website with the mission of getting people to share their favorite places around Miami. They launched a listener poetry project called This Is Where. What a great idea, we thought. WLRN asked pretty please for poems and got lots. They're still saying thank you. We want to replay, as a way of thanking you, two of the poems from that month that we got. This is from Eduardo Lis, who found peace at the edge of the Atlantic after he moved to Miami.
This is where I walked with nothing, unemployed, Walgreens bathing suit. Where I later splashed full of love and peaches. I go, it's there. No questions, no answers. Vast ocean, open winds. The roundness of the earth. I am just feeding the sand. I could be foam. The beach to be alone, breathe, to be together, laugh, to be in love, kiss, to dream with clenched fingers. The beach to bury your head in the sand or have the courage to do cartwheels.
Eduardo Lis, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're talking about a place within a place within a place there in South Florida. Describe.
Yes, well, you put it really well. I didn't think of it that way, but yes, I'm talking about the beach. And basically, when you are at the beach, you can see the roundness of the earth. You feel like you're standing there on top of the planet. Then inside of that, you are in a beach, a specific beach in Miami, in Miami Beach, and particularly the beach that I went to was the North Beach, basically between 71st and 75th Street near Collins. So that was basically my hangout place, especially when I first came to Miami 8 years ago.
I know it very well. And what about that beach welcomed you when you really needed some welcoming?
It was great because not only it's a fairly low-key beach, it's kind of quiet. People were playing volleyball on the beach and they were very friendly. So basically you can just ask and they'll invite you to play, even though I'm not the greatest player. So that talks very well about them. And so I started playing beach volleyball and I met a lot of people that way, but also like just the beach, just walking up and down the beach, going to the pier. So it was a very welcoming and also free place to go, especially when you have no money, when you first come here.
And you really were in a world of have-nots, a very, very close to a place, you know, South Beach, where there's paparazzi everywhere and celebrities and fashion shoots going on. And mm-hmm. just a few steps away, you found this sanctuary that really helped you at a pretty bad time in your life.
Yeah, it was, definitely that's the difference between the North Beach and the South Beach. There is the glamour of South Beach is not really there in North Beach. It's more, I don't know if you want to put it more like a family. So it was, it was really, really came very well at that time in my life, in which I did just needed to a place to not feel lonely and a place that I wouldn't be judged as far as money and, you know, what car you have.
And what was going on in your life at that point?
Well, I had just basically come to Miami. I was, I would say I was pretty alone. I had some issues in my love life. And I also was waiting for my work permit. So basically, I couldn't really work. I was a teacher before, and I was waiting for that. And the transition is not easy here. So I had to wait for a while. But the beach basically made it a little bit easier.
Did you bury your head in the sand in certain moments and do cartwheels in others?
Exactly. Yeah, many times. There being the bad times, and you kind of don't see things going your way that you want to bury your head in the sand. And then I met, I fell in love, and I met my wife. And then I guess I was eating peaches and doing cartwheels, like in the poem.
Eduardo Lees, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
We want to give a special thanks now to Jane Byron, a listener from Morristown, New Jersey, who shared a poem and her memories of faraway Camden, New Jersey, the place where she grew up.
This is where I bought my first house, where I had my first child and heard my first gunshots. Camden, the city Walt Whitman dreamed was invincible, and the city I tried to help rebuild. Camden, the city where children live and dreams die. Well, I grew up right outside of Camden, but it could have been 3 hours away. I grew up in a town called Oakland, New Jersey, which was about maybe 6 miles from Camden. And I had little contact with Camden growing up, but my mother was born and raised there. And she had great fond memories of the shipyards and RCA and the workers and her father and all the neighbors and her cousins. So I grew up hearing about a Camden that bore no resemblance to the Camden that I grew up knowing.
And the Camden you saw was filled with, and I'm just going back to my own memories of Camden, having been there a few times, liquor stores, buildings with no windows.
Right.
Vacant buildings.
And of course, prostitutes and drugs and needles and syringes and trash everywhere. And small children out on the streets just left to their own devices. That's kind of what I grew up with. But I also grew up with parents who were very active in the civil rights movement. And so Camden was also a place that we would go to and see this other side where there were political activists and priests. And I went to the Sacred Heart Church where Father Michael Doyle has been the Monsignor for a gazillion years. So I had these two sites of Camden, what came across on the Channel 6 news, and then what I saw through my parents' political activities, and then through the church that we often went to. So it was a very much a dichotomy of an experience.
You heard your first gunshots in Camden. When? Where?
In the back alley of the house that I gutted and rehabbed. My daughter was probably a year old, maybe two at the most at the time. And there was, you know, some shouting in the back alley, and then I heard gunshots, and then there was nothing.
The city you say you tried to help rebuild.
My mother was an early pioneer in Camden, where there was a historic district. And I was living in Los Angeles at the time when she bought a house in Camden, of all places. And so I came back to the East Coast in 1984, and I saw the beautiful home that she built. And it was on, you know, as sort of OK Street, because it was near Cooper Hospital and the University of Medicine and Dentistry. So I bought a house on the same street where my mother lived for $11,000 in 1985. And I got a HUD loan for $38,000. Because $38,000 even then couldn't do a total gut rehab. I did a lot of the work myself, and would tear down the plaster and lath and pack it up in bags and drag it to the curb for trash day each week. So that was my part of rebuilding. First of all, moving in and trying to have a stable presence and taking one trashed house and rebuilding it into a home for my daughter and me.
Walt Whitman, you write, dreamed that Camden was invincible, and it sounds like you discovered a city that was everything but.
Yes, especially in that time. I do think that perhaps it is a different story since I am not right there next to it, but I do know it's still absolutely crime-ridden. But there are things that my mother tells me that are going on where hope springs eternal for many.
You know, it sounds like from your poem that, you know, regardless of how disillusioning it was to be in Camden on some level, you retain a lot of affection for the place.
I do. And I think you can't literally peel the walls off with your hands with a baby in a backpack and not have fondness. There was a lot. I get emotional. It was a lot of hard work. And I am a dreamer.
Takeaway listener Jane Byron now lives in Morristown, New Jersey, though much of her heart still resides in Camden. One place where the Takeaway really came together this year as a community was in our breast cancer series, Under Her Skin. Crystal Miller, Anita Coleman, and Lisa Eccles have generously let us in on a challenging time of their lives, bonding as women together, making personal diaries for us from points on their survival journey, and building a community of listeners cheering them on and sharing their own challenges, joys, and pain. Zilka Pfluger heard about Under Her Skin while driving in her car listening to public radio one day, and she's become one of the most active members in the Facebook group we've created for this project. Zilka was diagnosed with breast cancer last year. She says the group was exactly what she was looking for or listening for.
You see that other people are going through the same thing. You can perhaps just pitch in if somebody has a question or about a treatment or side effects or whatever. And you can feel pretty safe asking questions as well. And to hear about it has really opened my eyes to the struggles of other women. So I think it's great that you do it and that you remind everybody that it's not the pink disease where it's like, oh, you get it and you get some surgery and a little bit of chemo and you're all fine, but that there's real struggle out there.
And what do you want to share? What do you think about your experience is really important for other people to know, either in terms of your fears, in sharing with your family, in your sense of, you know, the hourglass kind of determining your mortality, all that stuff that comes into play when you get a diagnosis?
What's really helped me there was to have a place where you can safely say things that frustrate you unbelievably. So I had a really, really bad comment early on by my mom. She said over dinner that the worst thing that can happen to a person is that they lose their child. And I just couldn't believe it because I was struggling with potentially dying early, you know, dying in my 40s or 50s. And she's worried about losing her child when she's 70 or 80. And I just couldn't believe it. And just to vent it out was extremely helpful.
And some people have observed that your cancer treatment has kind of become a sort of weight loss program and, hey, you're looking great. Real positive side. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's I wish I also could have a boob job and liposuction paid for by the insurance. Yeah. Do you also want to have my cancer? No, thank you. Then shut up and go away. But that's how you learn how to cut out people and, you know, just redefine your friends, I think. It's been over a year for me, and I have certainly changed how I am, who I am, and I'm not dealing with crap anymore. I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't say that on the radio.
Crap's okay. And there's nothing wrong with you being proud of your body, which is what you expressed.
Yes, I'm happier and I'm healthier and I have fabulous looking new silicone breasts. So what's not to like about it? What's not to like about it is that, you know, it may come back and then it's not going to be good. But it's a relatively low chance. So it's over 90% chance that I'll survive the next 5 years. I could always run in front of a bus or whatever. So I'll take it. I enjoy life. I go on vacations more than I did before. And I have a great husband that supports me in the whole thing.
Do you think this has made you a more tolerant, inclusive, maybe even caring person?
I'd say the whole breast cancer business made me a more inclusive and caring person. Though I have to say that I have extremely little patience for people that, oh, I have a headache today, I can't do this. When I get a headache, I don't get headaches very often. And so it's something very unusual and one of the places where breast cancer likes to metastasize to is the brain. And so when I get a headache, it's like, oh God, this is not good. Please go away. So I've become less caring for the common ailments, but I think I've become much more caring for for other people that have to struggle with cancer, with heart disease, with life-threatening, whatever, other life-threatening diseases.
Well, I'm so glad that this forum could have been a place for you to enhance experiences that you were already having, it sounds like, with the whole cancer experience.
Yep.
And, you know, there's one other benefit we haven't talked about here. That is, it seems to me that if you took a little initiative here, and I don't think she's too far away from you, is Anita Coleman would be happy to bring you some of her banana pie.
Ah, except that I don't eat sugar anymore since I got diagnosed. So,
well, Anita might, having been in her company, Anita might convince you to just suspend the rules for a day, and I guarantee you it would be worth it. Silke Pfluger, good luck to you, and thanks so much for being a part of our community on Under Her Skin. You've really sort of told us just how important and how it transcends even our modest journalistic goals in creating the site.
Thanks for making it available, and thanks for having me part of it.
You can join this community. Join our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin. What do you say? A couple more thank you stories from you guys out there?
Hi, I'm Robin Patton from Maplewood, New Jersey, and I teach at Columbia High School. I think the nicest thank you that I ever received was from a troubled student who was having a particularly rough year at school. He was failing miserably, about to be suspended or expelled for a number of academic issues and emotional outbursts. But I continued to reach out to him and appeal to his strengths, tell him I believed in his potential, and try to remind him of his future. He did disappear from school, and I lost track of him. But about a year or so later, we ran into each other in a restaurant in town where he was working, and he came up and said, "Thank you. I so appreciate the fact that you stuck with me. It meant everything to me, and I'm doing okay now." And after he walked away, I stood for the longest time realizing how much a small amount of support could do.
Hi, this is Don in Denver. Once I was flying back from somewhere, I don't know, and this young couple gets on the plane with what is obviously their firstborn. And as it happened, I was seated next to his wife and the child, and she was very concerned because Dad was a couple of rows back. So I said, you know, like, "Hey, you know, you want to switch seats?" To my surprise, it got a round of applause. What has stayed with me these 20 years gone was the look of gratitude in that boy's eyes. Happy Thanksgiving.
Got a great thank you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org. Here's a story to end this hour about a little girl who grew up all at once one surprising Christmas. Listen for the story in this next conversation. It was something we learned after hearing from Takeaway listener Judith Brown from New Jersey. We had playfully asked the question, "What's the biggest gamble you ever took in your life?" Her answer had nothing to do with lottery tickets.
I put out an abusive husband when my children were very young. I had no job and no money, but he was acting out, and the risk of harm to my girls was greater than the risk of poverty.
Judith went out on her own. Restraining orders, domestic abuse, single mom, three daughters, struggling actress and director, the works. She is now running her own successful consulting firm. It took a while for this big gamble, she told us, to pay off.
Before it all happened, I think probably by a couple of months, I'd read an article that said, you know, that divorced women tend to encounter a lot of financial difficulties, and there are a lot of challenges in that. And I thought, well, gee, that's a terrible thing. That's a sad thing to have happen. It had to have been, oh, I guess 3 or 4 months after I had separated from my husband that I realized that I was one of those people. Eventually, I finally got a good look at where we had landed, and you know, not that you land anywhere for very long, but and I got a chance to assess both the damage and the benefits.
How long were you homeless?
About 8 months.
You said in your message to us that the risk of your abusive husband was greater than the risk of poverty. Did you feel that even during those 8 months of homelessness?
We had gotten to the point where I didn't know what I was going to find when I came home at night. It was a long struggle to quell the violence and to come to terms. And so when it finally became obvious that my daughter's safety was going to be compromised, there was really no question.
And did they believe that all during the times you were in shelters and living in?
No. We didn't actually get to shelters. We were lucky enough to have friends and family. I think we only spent like a couple of nights in a hotel. That was pretty much it. But we had a lot of help from people. Did they believe it? No. In a lot of ways, I did a lot of storytelling around our situation. When we first landed in an apartment, I didn't have any beds. So I spun a real good tale about Japanese bed rolls, how this was really cool, and we're going to take all of the bedding, we're going to roll it up on the ground just like they do in Japan. Of course, you know, I didn't tell them that in Japan they have futons that are much more comfortable than sitting on the floor. So I did a lot of spinning, and in the moment it seemed to work. I think it wasn't until years later that they sort of turned around and went, hey, things were pretty tough. Creativity and adaptability is I think probably the best thing I own.
And what's going on today?
Oh gosh. Well, let's see. My girls are grown and I'm thrilled with the people that they are. And I just started a social media company. I took a master's in adult education and worked for a while in a national not-for-profit. And then as things changed there, as the economic downturn sort of took its toll on the not-for-profits, I found myself looking for another opportunity. And social media kind of presented itself to me.
What would you say are the lessons that you've learned from this gamble that you took about the people around you and the capacity of people to reach out and help someone in your situation?
I think those are two different questions.
Sure.
And I think they have the two different answers. I think personally, the thing that I learned was about resilience and about shedding illusions. My husband and I separated just around the holidays in 1993. And of course, you know, not too long after that, it snowed. And I found myself shoveling out my car, angry. And I couldn't figure why I was angry until I realized that what I was waiting for was I was waiting for some man to come and shovel out my car. And I always thought of myself as a strong woman. I didn't realize I had that belief. So learning to face my own illusions, that was the first thing. And learning to be adaptable, no matter what happens, there's always an answer. There's always a way out. Well, pretty much always a way out. As far as the people are concerned, I was stunned by the number of people who turned away from me, who turned away from the kids, and who didn't really want to do anything, have anything to do with us. Almost like a contagion. It was like something bad had happened to us, it would happen to them. But there were a few who turned out to be better friends than I had imagined. You know, they stuck with us for years. They gave us shelter. They looked after us. They found us, you know, ways to distract the kids, to take them on. I was amazed and still am at the generosity of spirit that some people demonstrated when we really needed it most.
Well, here's the story that your daughter Anna tells about observing you during this period of time. That we did this Christmas where we didn't have anything, and my mom didn't want that to happen again, and she'd been working three or four jobs, so she reached out to an organization, and they brought over a holiday meal and a few of the gifts she'd wanted, and we were really happy or whatever. She'd come over from these long jobs. It was interesting to watch her accept this stuff. I think that was the first time I saw her struggle. It was the first time I saw her struggle with anything.
I always thought of myself as protecting my family. And I realized that I felt that I had failed them. You know, I took away their comfort and their security, certainly their financial security. Their father was the breadwinner. I had a job with a children's theater, which, you know, didn't do much for us financially. And I really felt that I had let them down. So turning to an agency that that provided help like that was very hard, still hard to think about. You know, going to the food bank is not something that people do because they want to.
But still, it was the smartest thing to do, probably.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, it's smart, but it's difficult. You know, to compromise your pride like that is not easy.
Well, Anna told us that story, and it was as difficult for her as it is for you to hear. But we're certainly grateful that you shared this this story of taking a gamble. And I have to say that even though you felt like it was a gamble, it really seems like your kids were safe all the time.
Well, you know what? The risks that we ran, I tried not to let them see when I knew that we didn't have the rent or when I knew that we didn't have food. It was like I said, I did my best to keep as much of that covered up. You know, my dad used to collect pennies, and when the kids wanted to go to the movies, I would have them roll pennies, and they thought that this was great fun, except, of course, that your fingers smell afterwards. But they felt like this is what you had to do in order to go to the movies. So I tried to integrate things into life that that other people might have just taken for granted. I don't know. I tried to keep them safe.
Well, happy holidays, Judith Brown.
Oh, thank you so much, and the same to you and yours.
Thanks to Takeaway listener Judith Brown and to everyone who calls us, writes us on Facebook, finds us on Twitter, takes the time to share stories and ideas. We want to remind you of how you can make your voice a part of the Takeaway every single day. Be a part of our listener response network. You sign up for our texts. You'll get one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's show. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply. And you can reply STOP to opt out. Such a deal, huh? Did you get any better deals on Black Friday? No way. I'm John Hockenberry. See you next week. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.